Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine and widely available on all podcasting platforms. The sort of monsters I want to talk about this week are a new dominant force in the American political economy. This is the sort of crypto industry, which is still, like, in the grand scheme of things, relatively small, even in the tech world, but it has become like a real sort of King Kong, Godzilla type powerhouse in politics. To talk about all this is my guest, Jacob Silverman, who is a sort of tech finance journalist who's written a lot of on these issues, and especially has written recently in The Nation magazine on the rise of the crypto keepers. And one thing that first of all, Jacob, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And one point that you made in the article was that crypto was like the sort of biggest donor in the last election cycle in 2024. And I think even before that, in 2022, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it was 2020, but Sam Bankman-Fried was the one of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party. And he's, you know, obviously the former crypto king who is now in prison as a felon for his frauds. How did this industry, why is it, such a big donor, compared to things like, fossil fuel or other Wall Street concerns?
It's very unusual in a way. I actually think it deserves some emphasis in that way, but that not only was crypto the biggest donor in the last cycle, and as you said before, Sam Bankman-Fried was a major donor. Before he went down, he had sort of mused about spending $1 billion on the 2024 election on behalf of the mostly the Democrats. At least that was his idea at the time. But this is an industry that is not very economically productive or successful. It certainly is very prominent or punches above its weight pop culturally and in the media, but the consumer, in terms of the consumer base, the number of people who are using this, of course, the industry will tell you big numbers, but this is not something like pharma or oil or banking that, for better or worse, we kind of has a lot of economic activity and impact in our society. But they raised more than $200 million for Trump and the Republicans in the fall. I think one question I always have is, where does that money come from? But some of it comes from the VCs who have poured money into this, into these various crypto companies. And the main reason why, one main reason why they've emerged as this huge donor and the main backer in 2024 was that they need to change the rules of the banking system and just general regulatory arrangement in order to survive or thrive at all. And from their point of view, they've been oppressed by the powers that be, Democrats, Biden, the SEC, and Gary Gensler. But, from the point of view, I think, of a lot of Democrats and progressives, this is an industry that can only succeed by basically either breaking the law or creating new laws for itself.
Now, wait a second. I just want to be clear about this. What you're suggesting is that the sort of, you know, the tens of billions or hundreds of billions of dollars that the crypto money is putting in is done with an intent to change a regulatory environment, that there is a kind of quid pro quo here. And I just want to make like listeners aware that, you know, not everyone agrees with this, that Sam Bankman-Fried, when he was donating to the Democratic Party, had a champion in the form of very well-known pundit Matt Iglesias, who opined that Sam Bankman-Fried was motivated by an ideology of effective altruism, that this was philanthropic giving and is should be welcomed and is all to the good, and basically that there was no hidden agenda or no quid pro quo. So I just want to put that out there, that there is this alternative reading of the evidence. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, that was a useful sort of veneer on Sam Bankman-Fried's story back in the day, which is that he was donating to pandemic prevention efforts, and he had this supposedly very developed moral code, even as he was basically just running an offshore gambling den. But if anything, I mean, we know certainly from his trial and from his downfall that he was giving a lot of money to Republicans through various cutouts and straw donors, and that was run by basically his main Republican lieutenant, this guy named Ryan Salem, who's now in prison as well. And I think the difference now is that any sort of pretense of that there's a do-gooder aspect to this, or that, you know, it has been worn away. I mean, in some ways, Sam Bankman-Fried was seen as someone who's going to kind of make crypto safe for the masses. Mm-hmm. And that narrative is gone. And now it's just, you know, we are entitled to this from the perspective of the industry, you know, and combined with some typical right-wing ideas about economic freedom and money laundering being good.
I just kind of sarcastically or ironically bring up Bankman-Fried's claims of altruism for a purpose, which is like to try to map out the kind of ideological shifts that have been happening. And I will mention, you know, further to what you said, in the various trial transcripts and interviews and evidence that came out through discovery, I mean, there's a lot of evidence of Bankman-Fried, you know, like Matt Iglesias perhaps got this one wrong, because Bankman-Fried had speculated that if, you know, he gets into legal trouble, maybe he'll move to the right and yes, get Republican support, and gave other indications that that the claim of altruism was a fiction designed to advance his financial interest.
Absolutely. And I'm of the general opinion, you know, I attended the trial and covered it, and I'm of the general opinion that he's a sociopath of a typical variety that used effective altruism as, you know, this justification or sort of permission structure for everything he did. And certainly that's how he seemed to treat other people as just sort of means to an end.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is there's a longstanding sort of philosophical critique of utilitarianism, of which effective altruism is a variety, that it is just a cloak for bourgeois a desire for a possession and accumulation. I'm not necessarily sanctioning that critique, but if one wanted evidence for it, I think Sam Bankman-Fried provides.
Sure.
It would be a good case example. Yeah. Let's just say. Bankman-Fried had been like a Democrat, and I think there's a larger political shift, not just in crypto, but in the sort of tech world, where there was a period where tech kind of had an association with the Democratic Party and more broadly a kind of socially progressive liberalism. Going back to the Clinton era, but especially I think under Obama, there's a lot of sort of friendliness between Silicon Valley and the Democrats. With real policy implications that the Democrats saw a sort of nurturing and encouraging these industries as a way of creating, a base of financial and cultural support that would be to the good of the party. But there has been a shift where tech has moved to the right. And I think crypto is interesting in that it is one of, maybe it's the sort of cutting edge of this transformation with a lot of the venture capitalist people that, you had mentioned, had suggested might be financing this, had been previously Democratic Party donors, not just Sam Bankman-Fried, but, in Andreessen Horowitz, Ben Horowitz, was a big Democratic Party donor, and then he shifted to Trump. Can we talk a little bit about that? How
sure.
Crypto is a sort of bellwether for this larger ideological transformation of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it certainly is kind of on the leading edge of this transformation, I think. And the Obama administration was famously kind of a Silicon Valley revolving door and very chummy. Eric Schmidt, was the most frequent visitor of CEOs at the Obama White House. And, people from the administration went to work for Uber and Amazon and other places like that. I think a number of things changed, of course, but things changed both inside the tech industry. Some of these companies began to become a little more authoritarian, just in their construction as organizations. And I write about this in my next book. And one of the examples I use is protests at Google. All these companies are mini surveillance states and are surveilling their employees and have insider threat programs, just like the federal government does at intelligence agencies. More than 10 years ago, Google had something called Project Maven, where they had a small contract with the Department of Defense to do image analysis on drone video feeds. And it was basically, the idea was Google is doing work that was contributing to potentially targeting people for drone strikes. They were in that chain of production of intelligence. And people at Google protested. The company acknowledged the protest. They dropped the contract. It wasn't that much by Google standards. And then they kind of moved on. But more than a decade later, Google is way deep in military contracts again. They are, providing all kinds of tech and AI services to the Israeli government and the IDF. And so when you had protests during the last year and a half over Gaza by Google employees, silent protests, not disruptive, at Google offices, they were all fired immediately, those employees. This is sort of the case across a lot of these companies. And then as individuals, the CEOs and the VCs have... Some of them have radicalized themselves, and I think in general they have developed a supreme entitlement where they cannot stand that mild criticism started coming their way after 2016. I mean, I think this does describe part of Andreessen's transformation and part of Musk and some of these other guys, is that they really think tech critics or even some of the reporters of the New York Times are just, kind of evil, mean-spirited people who hate progress and won't let them build, and they want to build. And why are woke liberals getting in the way of them kind of, staking their kind of Howard Roark type claim to greatness and building? That's as far as it goes for them.
I think that's a very interesting sort of psychological point. But I think maybe we can sort of expand it out, because I think there's a kind of maybe a structural reason. I mean, it is absolutely the case that this is an industry that has a very antagonistic relationship to just like normal mainstream journalism, the sort of journalism that, the Wall Street Journal does, where, like if a company makes claims, you investigate it. There's a long history of this. I mean, I think, someone who was maybe really at the forefront of all this was Peter Thiel, and the way he destroyed Gawker. But I think, and you know, like, I'd really love to your thoughts on this. The reason for this is that this is a culture that depends heavily on hype and the kind of like sales pitch. And, you know, like, it has done amazing things. I mean, you know, tech has transformed the world. And, you know, you have things like Facebook that were nothing and then suddenly became huge industries. But you also have, like, for every Facebook, there's like, you know, like 10 or 100 other things that just don't pan out. But you need to raise money for it. You need venture. The whole process of venture capital requires sort of like hype and hyperbole. And when one sees this in like someone like Musk, who's all the time like making like wild, outlandish claims that do not stand up to any scrutiny. Like, you know, he was saying like 10 years ago, you know, we'll be on Mars in 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And I have to say, we're no closer to being on Mars now that that deadline has passed. But that's one example of many. I mean, I think in some ways a paradigmatic example would be someone like Elizabeth Holmes, right? Of, you know, like, you know, selling this great promise of this new tech. What was it going to allow you to do?
The Theranos blood test. Yes.
Yeah, blood test. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, and which was undone by, you know, kind of like journalism, like, you know, like once anyone checks out these claims, they're like in trouble. So one sees in this tech world like a kind of real obsession where like it's amazing, like there's like groups of billionaires, you know, and you look at their group chats and they're obsessed with Taylor Lorenz, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like a former Washington Post journalist, you know, kind of a controversial figure, but you know, like, it's just a writer, you know, currently just like, you know, she's just like the rest of us, just a Substacker, right? But these billionaires see her as an existential threat. And I think that it's because for their business model to work, you cannot have too much scrutiny. Like, actual
yes.
normal scrutiny, like, undermines how they can raise money for their projects, most of which are going to fail, you know, some of which might be successful.
Exactly. And I think, yeah, the it runs on hype, certainly, and the perpetual salesmanship and having to, you know, raise new rounds of capital every so often. And I think the other factor is that during kind of the ZIRP years, you know, the low interest rate years, or especially the last 10 years, they haven't produced a lot that's new. So, you know, Facebook can perhaps withstand some criticism because it's a thing that exists and it has a billion plus users. But, you know, crypto or NFTs or things like that or even AI, which is so far from delivering returns, both financial and returns on its potential, that's a real problem because the products are almost vaporous and the revenue streams aren't really there. So it is so vulnerable to criticism. Mm-hmm. And that may not have been, you know, if the startups, even if a lot of them fail, but if there were some that were more robust, let's say, you know, and were growing and going public, which there aren't that many going public anymore, then I think there wouldn't have been such sensitivity as you describe.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you mentioned this in passing, but I want to underscore it because I think it really gets at the political economy of this shift, which is the interest rates. You know, there had been a long period where interest rates were very low. And so it was very easy for them to raise money, to get up all sorts of like projects and not worry about it. And, you know, like as a byproduct of the COVID pandemic and then, you know, the economic shocks that happened afterwards, there has been a substantial rise in interest rates. And I think in that political economy, it was very, they had to be both A, more concerned about criticism, and I think also more concerned about cultivating ties with Washington, which they had already kind of enjoyed in a friendly sort of way, but was maybe a little bit, they might have felt any regulation now is more threatening. And the Biden administration, you know, did bring in certain Elizabeth Warren type ideas, about using the regulatory power of the state to create more competition. So in that kind of like, I mean, basically, it's easy to be a socially progressive liberal in good times, right?
Yes.
But when you're like capital is under threat, whether from workers, and there has been like strikes at attempts to unionize with Amazon, under threat from like higher interest rates, which make it give you a lot less room to maneuver. And under threat from government regulation and from the sort of progressive middle class movements that want regulation, then I think that all creates an atmosphere where a reactionary turn from Silicon Valley makes sense.
I think that's right. And there are two good supporting examples that both come from Mark Andreessen that cover kind of two aspects of what you were talking about, which is one is a story he tells. It may be in one of his online manifestos, that he was talking to a founder. I think it was a company CEO that was in his portfolio, a company he was funding. And they were talking, and one or the other said to them, but they were in agreement, basically, that they thought people, young communists out of college, were joining their companies to destroy them. That's what, like he said, before they used to protest sometimes. Now we think that they're joining our companies in order to like be agent provocateurs and destroy the company for ideological reasons. So they believe that. And then the other one was that for one of his supposed red lines, last summer when he came out in favor more directly for Trump, Mark Andreessen cited just the proposed capital gains tax on $100 million or more in capital gains, of unrealized capital gains. Mm-hmm. So obviously these guys don't want to be taxed. They don't want to be taxed on unrealized capital gains, but they are borrowing against this stuff and making money off of it anyway. But how many people are going to have to worry about $100 million in capital gains and being taxed against that? But to him, that was that he said that on his podcast, that was a red line for him.
No. I think that all makes sense. The only other aspect I kind of should mention is that there was a pre-existing right-wing culture in Silicon Valley, which I've talked about in previous podcasts, but the so-called California ideology of sort of libertarianism, but coupled with like darker, more authoritarian eugenicist and racist currents, we mentioned Anderson, but his it's Anderson Horowitz, and Ben Horowitz, even though he was for many years supposedly a progressive Democrat, his father is David Horowitz, notorious new leftist turned right wing reactionary, who had a lot of support, from the Silicon Valley world, and very much was in sort of, maybe at the a more lurid example of the sort of politics that one sees in someone like Peter Thiel or David Sachs, a kind of real culture war politics with a kind of like McCarthyist, anti-subversive, anti-communist view that like even the smallest bit of liberalism will open the door for the triumph of Stalinism in America, right? Like I mean that culture existed on the West Coast for a long time, and I think that once the more mainstream Democratic supporting billionaires for the sort of political economy reasons we outlined turned to the right, they had a ready reservoir of ideas that were in their ambient world, right? Like for Ben Horowitz, these are ideas that he would have gotten just from talking to his dad.
And he cited his father as an influence, and Mark Andreessen ended up basically drafting David Horowitz as an example of when he a few months back, or I can't remember, to be honest, if it started before or after the election, but he was talking a lot about debanking and conservatives, tech companies being debanked, supposedly. And this was, I mean, this is something that there's an ounce, a grain of truth to it, which is that a lot of banks over the during the Biden administration didn't want to work with crypto companies because it was either illegal or risky. And there was a lot, and there was guidance coming down from the Fed saying, you should be cautious, take certain measures, things like that. So there were reasons, kind of legal and practical, to not work with these companies. But it was recast as a deliberate sort of campaign of ideological persecution against conservatives and crypto and tech. And in one of his interviews, or maybe it was a podcast appearance, Mark Andreessen talked about David Horowitz being debanked because David Horowitz, I think, has wrote about this before he died, but his organization had a bank account closed. And I don't know the context of that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we do know, but and these things can happen, of course, unjustly. I mean, no one likes the banks, but but they can also happen for a lot of different reasons. But he invoked that as an example, and it was an interesting sort of bridging of the kind of politics you're talking about, and even of those generations where Mark Andreessen seems to really look up to David Horowitz in a way, and was proud to use him as an example.
Yeah. And I, to underscore this point, I don't think there'll be an obituary for David Horowitz forthcoming in The Nation. But, you know, David Horowitz was an extremely deranged individual of a sort where, regular, neoconservatives, National Review conservatives, they were often very wary of him because he was very incendiary on racial issues, maintaining, that basically George Floyd, kind of had it coming. So it is kind of remarkable to see these, one-time supporters of the Democratic Party latching onto the Horowitz of all people. But I mean, it kind of shows you, the sort of extremely reactionary politics that are at play here. So we've talked about, what we've mapped out now is the kind of left to right shift that has happened. But there's been another convergence on the other side, perhaps less dramatic, but I think notable in the figure of Donald Trump, who had been a crypto skeptic and is now his family's all into crypto in a way that actually is opening the door or has already opened the door to some of the biggest, perhaps the biggest corruption we've ever seen in American history. So let's talk about Donald Trump's shift.
Sure. So one of the few sensible things Trump may have ever said was that he thought crypto was a scam and he didn't like Bitcoin because it competed with the U.S. dollar or potentially undermined it. And that was during his first term. Of course, he changed his mind, just like he changed his mind about TikTok or other issues that the donor class decided he needed to change his mind about. And it happened during the course of the 2024 campaign cycle, really. By most accounts, his sons were a big influence. But also, there's the donor money coming in that started coming in, and the crypto industry declared itself all in for Trump and the Republicans. And then clearly he saw that this was an easy way to make money and that this is one of the most low effort grifts there is, especially for someone in his position. And that's why he started his first crypto company during the campaign cycle and was doing NFTs and things like that, but has since pretty much gotten into every aspect of the crypto industry. And there's nothing unusual or innovative about any of his ventures, of course. One way I've described it to folks, it's kind of like white labeled crypto products, the things that, white label products that come out of a Chinese factory and then get branded with different designs or something like that. He's just putting his name on standard versions of things. But yes, it has opened up these payment channels for him, or payment rails, as they say in crypto, that basically allow him to take in as much money as he wants. And he's taken in hundreds of millions and has a commitment for $2 billion deal involving Binance, the most corrupt crypto exchange in the world. It's astonishing.
Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps one aspect of that transformation with the Trump family, you mentioned the sons were at the forefront of this. My understanding is that after January 6th, the Trump family was having trouble getting some of the sort of business deals that they were expecting or had in the past, that there were, you know, people in sort of mainstream business communities that, you know, like were very wary of the Trump name because of its association, and that the family, you know, was able to find other sources. They doubled down on the, you know, connections with the Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia and whatnot, which had already been pre-existing, but like this created an incentive for that. And in some ways, like crypto might be a way to like launder or, you know, like some of that money, because my understanding is that a lot of the Arab kingdoms are heavily investing in Trump's ventures.
Yeah, so the $2 billion deal I refer to is there's a UAE investment fund, I believe a state affiliated, called MGX. They are investing $2 billion in Binance, which is the biggest and shadiest crypto exchange in the world, unofficially based in the UAE with some Chinese connections and offices elsewhere too. But they're doing it using a Trump-issued stablecoin, which is a token that is sort of like a digital dollar or a counterfeit dollar, depending on your definition. And so they're basically, this UAE fund is buying $2 billion worth of the Trump stablecoin, which is called USD1. And then they're using, and then they're giving that to Binance for an ownership share of Binance. And yeah, this also has the effect of pumping, because USD1 has a constant price, but putting a lot of it into the market and putting a lot of it on Binance. And Binance has offered free trades of this token of USD1, anything involving it. So basically, there are all these incentives and money being built towards promoting this Trump token that's going to be on Binance and elsewhere. And probably, I mean, frankly, probably widely used in money laundering. Binance, for those who don't know, was ordered to pay a $4.3 billion fine, the biggest fine in U.S. corporate history. I don't know if they have succeeded in paying that before Trump has started making some of their legal problems go away. Their CEO, Changpeng Zhao, kind of saw the writing on the wall, pled guilty to some money laundering violations and spent 4 months in federal prison. And he's back in the UAE. So this is, you know, an incredibly sketchy organization. This is just one piece of what Trump is doing in crypto. But it is one of the most clearly suspect. And yeah, the UAE has become a real center for crypto finance. I mean, it's where also like Russians can come sometimes and, you know, Russian oligarchs or whoever, and do deals and move money potentially. And potentially get it to the West.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very, very just sort of like troubling. And I mean, there's even like other types of crypto, which we can't give the commonly used names because we're a family podcast. But, you know, like are basically worthless. And what's a euphemism that's used for this?
They're often called meme coins, or the euphemism that's approved by Congress is fecal coin.
Fecal coin, yeah, yeah. And one can imagine that, you know, there's like words that, you know, one shouldn't use in polite company that are used to describe these coins. And then Trump is also involved with that. I mean, think about Trump's like larger evolution, which I think kind of parallels like the evolution of capitalism in the late 20th and 21st century. It has been a move from the physical and real world into increasingly sort of mediatized and fictional capital. That's to say, you know, Trump, you know, the families started off actually in real estate, you know, which is real estate, like it's actual land. And this is how Trump, you know, made his name, but was actually like not that good in it, and then ran into a lot of trouble again with the rise of interest rates and the sort of various banking crises of the late 1980s and early 1990s. But Trump was saved by the fact that he did not just real estate, but he did sort of like branding. You know, he had done the book, The Art of the Deal. He had made himself this public figure of I'm the face of capitalism. And his brand was actually worth money to the banks, even as his real estate ventures had all failed. And he was kind of like saved by that fact, and saved by the fact that he's able to move into reality TV and become the, you know, like an entertainer. And sell his brand for various products. And it seems like even though he's initially wary of crypto, crypto is a kind of and these meme coins, they're the further extension of this, like away from physical reality into the realm of like purely speculative, conjectural reality, you know, that exists only in cyberspace.
Yeah, that's well put. And it's really almost he can always go farther, I suppose, but there's some way in which this seems like the final endpoint of that tendency, because meme coins, and speaking specifically about, there's one called Trump coin, and then there's the Melania token also. These things are worthless. I mean, there's nothing underlying them. It is just literally like a name in a database. You know, I could make a Jacob coin right now that would, in a minute, that would be no different than Trump coin. It would just be called Jacob coin. Because he is the ultimate embodiment of sort of walking publicity and hype, that, of course, it's the perfect match for him, because meme coins are only about hype. And there's no effort involved, as I said, and no real economic outlay or overhead. So it was only natural in a way. It certainly, in retrospect, it does seem surprising it took so long, but perhaps it had to be explained to him, like, hey, Dad, you just slap your name on this stuff. It's not really real, but people are going to put money in your pocket. Yeah. And there you go. And he clearly doesn't understand it, of course, and he doesn't even really seem to know, I think, what's happening day to day with some of this stuff when a journalist occasionally ask in interviews, but he knows that the money's coming in.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is a way of just like making money by, you know, proclaiming money by just, you
yeah.
know,
yeah. I mean, he created his own money that he's selling to people. So, you know, and of course this extends up to people like, there's this Chinese crypto entrepreneur, Justin Sun, who bought $75 million worth of Trump token. He's going to be at the dinner of 220 top token holders. And then the SEC drops Sun's lawsuit a fraud investigation into Sun.
Well, I mean, that is the aspect of reality that's here that, you know, would not be allowed. That what it is on the one hand, you are there's these fictional fiat money, like, you know, money that only exists because you proclaim it, and it can only be really useful for like either criminal activities or, you know, activities that financial activities that skirt the law. But to actually make this work, you actually have to have the actual real lever of state power. That if you're the president, you have the power of pardon. You also, you know, under Trump, can like dictate to your Department of Justice who gets prosecuted and who doesn't. And so it's that component of state power that like allows this this whole enterprise, which is like otherwise a pure kind of like, you know, I wouldn't even say Ponzi scheme. It's like a P.T. Barnum, you know, get rich quick medicine, like, you know, like,
yeah, patent medicine. Yeah.
It's just quack medicine. But like with the support of state power, then it becomes something a little bit more.
Yeah, and I think what's worth noting also, I mean, that gives him the impunity. That means that this can go on indefinitely, perhaps, or at least I wonder, like, what mechanisms do you stop it? And then the other aspect of it is that he has very deliberately integrated, of course, his business interests with his official offices. So Steve Witkoff and his son, Zach, are co-founders of World Liberty Financial. And Steve Witkoff, you know, I believe is a real estate billionaire.
Yeah.
And he's Trump's top diplomatic envoy to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. He's also done negotiations with Russia. He actually negotiated a prisoner swap that involved releasing a guy who had laundered billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin through a crypto exchange back to Russia. So, and there's been reporting in Business Insider and the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere that in some of his meetings overseas, Steve Witkoff is telling foreign governments, you need to buy Trump coin or you need to be on board. And of course he would. I mean, and I've also said that this is in the interests of foreign governments or anyone who wants something from Trump, of course, whether you're a CEO, but if, you know, if you're the leader of Azerbaijan and you want some favor from Trump, you might buy $20 million worth of Trump token and let them know about that or send Steve Witkoff a message. This is the most obvious way to do this. And it's practically a matter of self-interest or who's going to stop them.
Yeah, yeah. And this is like a broader issue with sort of Trumpian corruption. The Washington Post actually had very good reporting about how the American government is pushing other governments to use Elon Musk's Starlink. And so there's a way in which that sort of Silicon Valley world, not just with crypto, but with other things, mm-hmm. has like become integrated with the presidency. In your piece, you bring up some of the ideological kind of undergirdings of this, and it's as with Sam Bankman-Fried's utilitarian effective altruism, it's hard to know how much of this is like, you know, genuinely sincere ideology or is just a front, because it's a long-standing libertarian opposition to the Federal Reserve and towards what they call fiat money, which comes from a distrust of centralized power and the state. And also, I would argue, maybe a profoundly antisocial individualism, which distrusts like the kind of common currency that we all use because that implicates us in society. But in the past, that ideology, libertarian ideology, was aligned with gold. It was the sort of gold bugs going back many decades, who said, you know, like the, you know, federal government's going to go bankrupt, you got to be investing in gold. And yeah, you know, say what you want about the gold bugs, but like to me, like there is a certain logic, like, you know, gold does have value, it does exist in the world, and you could kind of see, like, you know, from historical examples that maybe like if there is a, you know, social breakdown, you know, maybe having some gold coins could help. But like, so it's interesting to me that like a lot of the gold buggery, which is still there, but has also become aligned with crypto, which to my mind is the opposite of gold. it's actually much more fictional than a government based backed currency.
Not in the minds of Bitcoiners, though. They think that they call Bitcoin they call it hard money or the hardest money there is. The gold bug comparison, I mean, is made a lot and has certainly influenced their own ideology. And they have similar ideas about the U.S. is going to go bankrupt. The Federal Reserve is a Ponzi scheme. Everything is a Ponzi scheme except for Bitcoin. Perhaps that's the power of delusion ideology, but they have convinced themselves of that. But it is funny because that does still underlie, or that animated Bitcoin, certainly in its early years. And there are some people now who are like, hey, I'm a Bitcoin purist. Why are we working with the government? Why is there a national Bitcoin reserve? Why, you know, on all these different levels is the industry kind of making common cause with the state. And that's an increasingly small number of people in the crypto industry. Because I think
There's very few pure libertarians when you need a bailout.
Exactly. And this is an industry that has realized it needs fresh infusions of capital, and it lost its consumer base after the 2022 crash. Mm-hmm. And they have really turned more towards institutional money, and institutional investors and trying to get Wall Street money, and now the government. And so, and then it involves also, you know, changing regulations accordingly. But that's where they see their money coming from, because they aren't being very successful at orange pilling the masses.
Yeah. So I mean, that does kind of point towards these sort of like ideological contradictions. And I think there's some more that are sort of pointed in your article, because there's this weird thing where this alternative currency is also being justified as a way of shoring up the American dollar, that this is a way of stopping de-dollarization. You know, I mean, with a lot of Trump's things, like, you get like a very strange sort of contradictory messages. It's like with the tariffs, like, are the tariffs so you can have economic self-sufficiency, or are they being used to like as a bargaining chip to open up other markets? I mean, those are two different things, but Trump says both of them. And with de-dollarization, you both hear like a kind of desire for de-dollarization, where like this will give the US more freedom and leeway. But then also saying that this, like, by, you know, investing in an alternative currency will stop de-dollarization. Just on a logical level, a lot of this stuff doesn't make any sense, but it seems like sort of pretextual.
And recently, one way in which they're trying to kind of resolve some of these contradictions, or one of the lines that they're at least giving, is they talk about extending dollar dominance or extending dollar hegemony through stable coins. Mm-hmm. So since a stable coin is nominally supposed to be worth a dollar and like represent a dollar and kind of is a substitute digital dollar, that you're giving people around the world exposure to the US dollar and access to it. But of course, via private crypto companies.
Yeah.
But that's that's supposed to be good for America, mm-hmm. and that's them kind of having it both ways a little bit. Like, we're issuing our own money, we're issuing our own arguably counterfeit dollars, but actually, you know, the poor people in Lebanon or Nigeria can't get a real U.S. dollar, so we're going to give them this token, and that's, you know, that's good for America. Mm-hmm. And this is a line also that specific language of extending dollar dominance or extending dollar hegemony. I've heard it from like the CEO of Tether, the biggest stablecoin company, and I've heard it from people in Congress who have started saying it, right wingers in Congress. Mm-hmm. So they've gotten the message.
Yeah, I know they've gotten the message, but I think the theme of our conversation has been that maybe one should be a little bit skeptical of these kind of like ideological presentations and look at the real issue, which is, you know, like a fundamentally shady industry which has gained, you know, considerable power in both political parties, and which is like, you know, I think the real danger here long term is destabilizing, you know, the financial system, especially the American financial system, which has never, you know, since the deregulations of the 70s and 80s has, you know, been kind of shaky already. But this is like, you know, like a sort of backdoor way into, you know, returning to sort of casino capitalism.
Absolutely.
Of a sort which, you know, if one remembers 2008, you know, can do like tremendous real world damage, even though it's a fictional currency.
Right. And the danger the next time around, when there's an inevitable crypto bust because they have such rapid boom and bust cycles and there are no fundamentals there, is that it's not just going to be the retail traders who lose out like in 2022. You heard me. Going to be the fact that now retirement accounts, union. Mm. I wrote an article for The Nation about a private sector union that bought Bitcoin, whose members are pretty unhappy. There are public sector unions buying crypto, they're buying stocks of crypto companies. There are just ways in which our financial system and people's retirement accounts especially are becoming exposed to crypto, so that when the thing blows up, you have contagion or some larger calamity more reminiscent of 2008.
Yeah. On that, unfortunately, very dire note, we'll have to wrap up the conversation.
But, pardon me for that.
But I want to thank Jacob for this very enlightening conversation.
Thank you.